To his colleague's horror, the opinion began with an excursus into Frankfurter's own identity as a Jew. "One who belongs to the most vilified and persecuted minority in history," he wrote, "is not likely to be insensible to the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution." He went on to refer to his career as defender of civil liberties. "Were my purely personal attitude relevant, I should wholeheartedly associate myself with the general libertarian views in the court's opinion, representing as they do the thought and action of a lifetime." Several justices begged Frankfurter not to publish the opening lines of his opinion. Frank Murphy, closely identified with the Catholic Church and the only other non-Protestant on the court, told Frankfurter that his opinion was too personal, and that his words would be catapulting a personal issue into the arena. Frankfurter replied to Murphy that his self-reference would be personal if he were using his identity as a basis for his decision. But in fact, Frankfurter insisted, he was doing just the opposite, by asserting that the Constitution required the judge to put aside his particularity. "As judges," he had written, "we are neither Jew nor Gentile, neither Catholic nor agnostic. We owe equal attachment to the Constitution, and are equally bound by our judicial obligations, whether we derive our citizenship from the earliest or the latest immigrants to these shores." Owen Roberts also came to Frankfurter telling him that on reflection, he considered the words more and more a mistake. Frankfurter gave Roberts a lengthier explanation. He had, he said, been flooded with letters criticizing his original opinion in the flag salute case, on the ground that I, as a Jew, ought particularly to protect minorities. Since the issue had come back to the Supreme Court, he had received a new trickle of letters, telling him that as a Jew and an immigrant, his duty was to reverse his vote. The letters, said Frankfurter, convinced him that he needed to tell the world that individual background was irrelevant to the business of the Supreme Court. Frankfurter was trying to express his own tortuous identity. The more anyone told him that he had judicial obligations as a Jew, the more crucial it became to insist that as a judge he was no more and no less than an American. Roberts said that he accepted the answer. What else could he say? As he brooded about it, though, Frankfurter found that he was unsatisfied with the exchange. Murphy's concerns about Frankfurter's opening lines could be explained by his desire to deflect attention away from his own Catholic identity. But Roberts was an ordinary white Republican Protestant who had no particular stake in such matters and who was easily influenced by others. Why had he asked Frankfurter to change the text of his opinion? In his diary, written with future biographers in mind, Frankfurter surmised that Roberts had been put up to it by Black. Although Roberts and Black would later split violently, they were, at the time, good friends. Black and his wife Josephine regularly visited Roberts at his Pennsylvania farm. Black's motives for trying to stop Frankfurter from drawing attention to the personal domain would have been complex. As a former Klansman, he had a reason to want the justices' personal backgrounds to be kept out of Supreme Court opinions. Frankfurter made the point obliquely, if ungenerously. What moved Black, I do not know, except his general philosophy about not mentioning such things. He is a great fellow for keeping things under cover. This was a reference to Black's hiding his Klan membership from Roosevelt and everyone else before becoming a justice. Then Frankfurter pushed it still further. To me, on the contrary, to keep all reference to anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism hidden is the best kind of cover under which evil can operate. Anti-Catholicism was, alongside racism and anti-Semitism, a mainstay of the Klan's worldview. In the interests of posterity, Frankfurter was justifying his very public reference to his own Jewishness as a blow against the secret bias he was ascribing to Black. If Frankfurter's opening was driven by the challenges of his innermost identity, the rest of his opinion sought, fatefully, to defend the principle of judicial restraint. Although he sensed it only incompletely, Frankfurter was facing the most important crossroads of his judicial career. For more than a quarter of a century, while conservatives controlled the Supreme Court, Frankfurter had argued that judges must allow Democratic majorities to act as they pleased, even when their decisions were fundamentally flawed. Now liberals had a majority on the Supreme Court, and they were arguing that the court should intervene to protect the rights of minorities. Frankfurter realized that if he remained a stalwart of judicial restraint, he would be condemned by the liberals whom he had hoped to lead. But having made a career arguing against judicial interference in the majority's decisions, Frankfurter chose to stick to his guns. The beauty and also the tragedy of Frankfurter's constitutional vision were captured in this stance. Consistency was for him the hallmark of good judging. The error of the court in the Lochner era had been to overturn legislation when it served the interests of property owners and capitalists to do so. And Frankfurter had criticized the majority for following its economic and class interests. Now he felt he had to show commitment to a principle, regardless of whether he liked the consequences. If judicial restraint had been appropriate when conservatives controlled the court, it must still be the right doctrine now that the liberals had the votes. Having articulated the theory of judicial restraint, echoed by other liberals when they did not control the Supreme Court, Frankfurter found himself the sole liberal advocate of keeping to that theory when it was no longer politically expedient. For other liberals, judicial restraint had been simply the right idea for the right moment, a powerful way to criticize a conservative court that stood in the way of progressive reforms. Now that the conservatives were out of power, the liberals saw good arguments for treating civil liberties as very different from property rights. They already believed the court should not impose its economic values on the majority. But for the court to protect religious or racial minorities was different from protecting the minority made up of property owners. These minorities, the liberals came to believe, needed the protection of the courts. As the other liberals on the court shifted ground, Frankfurter, to his astonishment, found himself transformed into a conservative. Frankfurter's critics, then and later, have tried to explain how it could be that the country's best-known liberal became its leading judicial conservative. But the source of the change was not Frankfurter, whose constitutional philosophy remained remarkably consistent throughout his career. It was the rest of liberalism that abandoned him and moved on once judicial restraint was no longer a useful tool to advance liberal objectives. The question remains, of course, why Frankfurter chose consistency once the writing was on the wall. He was not an ideologue in the years before he went on the court. If Frankfurter's liberalism was open to revision, why did he not revise the ideal of judicial restraint? The answer lay in what Frankfurter had told his colleagues during the Schneiderman case, that the Constitution had replaced Judaism as his religion. The obligation of the judge was to demonstrate loyalty not to any one particular identity, but to the Constitution itself.